Long before ChatGPT, Siri, or Alexa, there was Eliza.
Eliza is a computer program that anyone can converse with via the keyboard, and it'll reply on the screen.
Created in 1966 by MIT professor Joseph Weizenbaum, Eliza was one of the first chatbots. But unlike today's AI assistants, Eliza didn't answer questions. It asked them.
Men are all alike.
In what way?
They're always bugging us about something or other.
Can you think of a specific example?
Weizenbaum designed the program to mimic a male therapist using open-ended questions to guide conversations. His intent was to prove that conversations with machines would be, well, robotic. But his lab results showed the opposite. People testing Eliza quickly became engrossed, engaging in deep, emotional conversations.
It's as if it really understood what I was saying.
But it doesn't, of course. It's just a bag of tricks.
This phenomenon of believing a computer truly understands us would become known as the Eliza effect. Eliza challenged the idea that computers were simply tools for logic and calculation and paved the way for more sophisticated AI. It raised important questions about the role of machines in our lives, questions that continue to resonate today in the debate over Section 230 and the future of the internet. I'm Mike Masnick. This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet. And today, we're taking on some of the toughest topics around.
All of the policy issues that have been raised by computing over time, now they're being sort of swept under an AI label.
You cannot put knowingly your technology in the hands of sex traffickers.
We'll enter the debate over the future of the internet, and we'll search for a satisfying solution.
All of these conversations would be more productive if people were more used to thinking in a defensive driving mode instead of a sort of consumerist, preferential, what is the best television mode.
If you were unhappy about illegal activity on the internet, just wait until it can't be moderated at all.
Last episode, we traveled the world to explore how different countries handle speech online.
What that meant was more of a kind of duty of care in the European Union.
And we heard how some countries are taking a stand against U.S. tech giants that break their laws.
It's not that these big tech companies can push around countries. You can do lots of other things to make it impossible for that platform to operate in that country.
Back in the U.S., tech platforms have their own problems, beginning with AI.
AI is another more powerful tool, and it's going to be used by those people for basically really evil purposes.
A new report offers a troubling look at the latest digital threat to young people, deep fake nudes.
Do we need to put in far more restrictions and backstops on this? How do we solve this problem?
Artificial intelligence, yeah, it's been around a long time.
Neil Chilson is the former chief technologist at the FTC. Now he's the head of AI policy at the Abundance Institute, a nonprofit focused on emerging technologies.
I remember when I first got into computers when I was, in junior high, the cutting edge of AI research at that point was chess playing games. So every time something works, they stop calling it AI, and then it becomes just regular computing. So our phones are now packed with hundreds of algorithms that were cutting edge AI applications at some point, everything from character recognition, facial recognition, the ability to recognize speech and transcribe it. All of those are things that were at some point really difficult artificial intelligence problems. So in some ways, you know, anytime you hear somebody say AI, you could just substitute in advanced computing, and that would probably work just as well.
The term artificial intelligence came about in the 1950s, but it's never been more relevant than today, thanks to large language models.
And so ChatGPT is the most popular one. It became the fastest adopted application ever in the history of computing, but this is not new. In fact, even the underlying algorithms for large language models had their origins back in the 70s with neural networks. And the big difference is that they didn't have the computing power or the massive amounts of data to make these algorithms work.
These tools stopped being just simple chatbots a long time ago. Now they can even help you be more creative.
Now you can do like a custom image on the fly that is exactly what you wanted, right? And to that extent, that lowers the barrier for that form of communication. If you haven't spent time brainstorming about the next thing you want to write, whether it's a letter to your grandma or your Christmas cards or an essay that you have to do, if you haven't spent time brainstorming that with ChatGPT or a similar tool, you really should try it out. And so I just think it lowers the barriers to creating new things. And that's good for free speech overall.
So here we are with a new technology that has incredible potential for our speech and expression. And with that new technology comes fear. Sounds a lot like what happened with the internet back in the 90s. And just like back then, today's tech companies have trust and safety specialists.
My task was to get smart as quickly as possible from all of those folks about what can it do? What do we know how to get it to not do? And so how do we build a set of systems to account for what people are going to try to do with it?
That's Dave Wilner, the guy who wrote the first community guidelines at Facebook and later worked at Airbnb. In 2022, he was tapped by OpenAI, creator of ChatGPT, to be their head of trust and safety. Even with his experience, this was a new set of challenges.
How do we sort of like glue all of that together into some sort of functioning system? And also, what should our rules be, given that we're running initially an API business with developers, which is sort of a different set of standards than a first-party business, and then was also sort of trying to build out an initial operations and technical infrastructure, and I'm working with the people building out the technical infrastructure to do the monitoring and intervention.
The debate over moderation takes on a whole new dimension with AI. It has so many applications.
There are certain things that are contextually appropriate for certain apps that are not for every app. So like if you're a note-taking app for doctors, people are going to talk about a bunch of like sexual organs, and that's completely normal and boring and fine. And so if you have a system that can't accommodate that, you've just ruled out a like extremely banal and sort of obviously good use case for summarization and note-taking machines. But also maybe you don't want your consumer app, which you're gearing up to launch, to be like mostly for people making custom erotica for brand reputation reasons.
It's not just note-taking apps and chatbots.
You can just think in image diagnostics. We already have tools that use this same underlying technology, these deep learning models, to easily spot, in many cases, much earlier than human doctors can, cancerous growths, for example, from radiology. And so the medical applications are enormous. But this is true for any area where we have large, complex systems with a ton of data, and it's really hard to tease out the patterns. Another recent breakthrough that was really interesting to me is that Google's DeepMind has developed some weather models that have been trained on historic data of weather movements and can generate models that are quite accurate into the future. We always hear that AI is like uses a ton of energy, but in this particular case, it actually uses less energy than the massive physics simulations that weather predictors have used in the past.
So AI has a ton of great uses, but the fears remain. Parallels to the early internet are causing some deja vu in the tech policy world.
The biggest challenge right now is that AI is swallowing all of tech policy. So all the same fights are back. We have IP, intellectual property fights. We have privacy fights. We have misinformation, disinformation. We have speech, content moderation type issues. We have liability issues. It's basically all of them. One of the big challenges is just explaining to policymakers the difference between AI at the model level, this abstract tool that's out there, and AI as applied. And so in many cases, there's already quite a lot of regulation around, say, medical devices that use computer software. And so are there gaps maybe in those? Maybe, but we should explore at that level and not spend so much time like trying to regulate AI as AI. Let's focus on the applications.
Those sweeping regulations sound a lot like what the authors of 230 were facing in the early days.
I think there are a lot of lessons that can be taken from Section 230 and from the success of the internet in that space. The primary one is that free speech is a mess, but it's way better than the alternative. There are a bunch of lessons from not just Section 230, but the entire set of issues around the creation or the communication of content and the pressures that there are, both market and government, to shape what that content looks like.
To me, that feels like we're now entering an area that wasn't fully anticipated when people were writing Section 230.
Dave Wilner, trust and safety expert again.
We're not in a totally different universe, but this sort of hybrid machine-human writing project feels like we're now getting to like pretty far away from the technological conditions when 230 was written. If we were in a world where all the open source language models could teach anybody to make all the chemical weapons and like sarin gas they want, and people had a demonstrated propensity to actually go do that, yeah, we probably should lock that shit down to like four large companies that the government can keep an eye on. Like, I don't know. That seems like the right trade-off to me. Like, some sort of due diligence logic seems to me to start to apply at that point, in the same way that like we expect Boeing to build planes that don't blow up, and also we expect pilots to not do stupid things.
It's still unclear what the answer is for how to regulate AI, but there's clearly an appetite to hold internet platforms more accountable, especially in the courts.
My name is Carrie Goldberg, and I'm the owner of a law firm in Brooklyn, New York that sues big tech and total assholes. My dad subscribed to Prodigy when I was in junior high and high school. And I took over the account, and I was very active in the bulletin boards and had all these long-distance boyfriends, and ultimately got us kicked out over and over and over again. And he would get so mad at me because his account would get suspended for days.
That's slightly ironic, given you know the Prodigy and their moderation in some ways then led to Section 230, which you now spend a lot of your time litigating against.
I know. I'm the test case.
Carrie Goldberg is one of the most vocal critics of Section 230 and has represented defendants in some of the most high-profile challenges the law has seen.
I saw that there were these websites that just published revenge porn, myex.com, and then companies like Google would populate victims' search results with links to those websites. And so victims basically had no way to get beyond the revenge porn because it was all over their Google results. And so I was just like, oh my God, like this is intentional infliction of emotional distress. We need to sue these websites. And very quickly I realized there is this blockade called Section 230, which basically immunizes the platforms so long as users were the ones posting the material and not the actual website administrators. So that began my crusade against Section 230.
One of her first big cases centered around dating app harassment.
I got this client who told me that his ex had been impersonating him on the dating app Grindr and had been creating all these fake profiles using my client's pictures and then setting up dates for strangers to go to my client's home. My client had, Matthew Herrick, he had reported it to the police and had been trying to get an order of protection, but nothing was stopping this guy. And Matthew was getting as many as like 23 visitors a day that would show up at his home, would follow him to work, would recognize him at the gym. I mean, it was like a total freaking disaster. And it was incessant. I thought, oh, I'm going to just call up Grindr's general counsel, tell them that this guy needs to be removed. And I sent them a letter and emailed them, and they totally blew me off.
So Goldberg went to the New York Supreme Court to get a restraining order to prevent Grindr from allowing her client's ex to continue using the app.
Grindr removed the case to federal court and then said, we don't have any duty to remove this user. Like, we're totally protected from Section 230. And they're like, even if we wanted to, we couldn't remove this user because we don't actually have the technology to stop a user from creating new profiles. At that point, the ex-boyfriend was also creating profiles on other apps. And so we knew that other apps had the ability to stop him because they were using his MAC address and his IP address to sort of flag when he was creating new accounts. But Grindr was saying they didn't have that technology. So I was really confident that this was outside the reach of Section 230 because we were not suing Grindr for content. We said this is about like the product, the apparatus, how it functions, and not content.
The judge disagreed and ruled against Goldberg and her client, saying that Section 230 grants broad immunity. Carrie appealed, lost, and appealed again, all the way up to the Supreme Court. But the suit was unsuccessful.
So I licked my wounds for almost 2 years after the Herrick v. Grindr defeat. And then in 2020, I got a case. Basically, it was a child who had matched with a pedophile on Omegle. And then he, for 3 years, made her his basically online sex slave. So she was 11 when they matched. Omegle's a live streaming product that matches strangers for video chatting. She had no insight into the fact that this man who was in his 30s was truly victimizing her. So we sued Omegle saying that its matching function was a defect. And here, Omegle's advertising itself to people 13 and up. It has no actual age verification. It was known that it was a live streaming app for sex and populated by tons of children. And so once you know that your product is basically creating like child sex victims, then you need to change it. So it was really a similar argument saying this is a defective product, failure to warn, negligence. And we overcame Section 230 on everything except for the negligence.
This was one of the few cases in U.S. history that successfully overcame Section 230. It ultimately led to Omegle shutting down.
I only bring cases where a product has been weaponized in a foreseeable way, or there's something about how the product functions or a feature of the product that makes it so that the injury my client faced was really predictable to the product, or there have been tons of other incidents that are similar.
It was every single client. Where did you meet your trafficker? Facebook, Instagram, every single one of them. It was undeniable across the board.
Annie McAdams is another victim rights attorney who has dedicated her practice to representing those who claim to have been harmed by big tech. In 2022, she brought a lawsuit against Facebook for its alleged role in the sex trafficking of a then 15-year-old client. Facebook cited Section 230 as part of its defense, and ultimately, a district court granted Facebook's motion to dismiss on Section 230 grounds. That decision was recently appealed to the Ninth Circuit.
It really has been a troubling thing to see the way that the tech industry has inappropriately, and quite honestly, I'll say in some circumstances, unethically, from a legal standpoint, asserted this defense in this litigation. 230 comes up right out the gate, right? It doesn't serve us anymore. This interpretation, wrong, doesn't serve us.
McAdams says she respects the rulings in the cases that led to Section 230, but has problems with everything that happened afterward.
Go back to the literal text of 230. Both of those orders, and absolutely zero disrespect to either judge, took a very atextual approach. The word immunity does not appear in Section 230. No liability is not immunity. Well, I actually think the end result was correct, right, in finding no liability. But I don't think it should have been based on an immunity ground. Right? The way that they got there has what has set us off on 20 years of misinterpretation and application of Section 230.
McAdams' main concern is the assumption of immunity. She says that procedural fast lane created by Section 230 takes away victims' right to their day in court.
But if you look at the crux of those cases, 230 is doing their job in those cases. That's not how you fix the internet. The internet's not the only problem there. That's a societal harm. You know, changing and increasing regulation is not going to solve that harm, right? There's a bigger harm there. Whereas something that is much more in line with what the text of 230 says is going to protect against significant litigation. I still believe you should face a 230 challenge. I mean, look, you're never going to prevent from a third party content person posting something crazy, but you cannot put knowingly your technology in the hands of sex traffickers.
There's a lot of space between the Annie McAdamses of the world and the Dave Wilners, and we're nearing the end of our journey. So is there a clear path forward? In today's debate over the future of Section 230, there are three main stances: repeal it, reform it, or leave it as is. You might be surprised where victim rights attorney Annie McAdams lands on that debate.
Well, I would tell you I wouldn't change a bit. I really wouldn't. Let the courts do what the courts are doing right now. They're doing exactly what the justice system is supposed to do. And so give them a little bit more time. But if you are forcing me to do something, I would say that part about face no liability, put an asterisk there for all the non-lawyers or the ones that don't understand the difference between, you know, not liability is not immunity.
I mean, my preference is just to abolish it altogether.
Carrie Goldberg, who represents victims of harassment and stalking online, is much firmer in her stance on 230.
I feel that our legal institution already has methods to go after offenders without needing this additional protection for internet companies. I mean, it's not 1995 anymore. These companies really shouldn't get this kind of tax break or this assist from the government. No other industry does, not even the gun industry, when it comes to like a product malfunctioning. We're already in a world where frivolous lawsuits can exist, and no other company or industry gets this sort of right to not have to deal with that.
This might not come as a surprise, but Carrie lands on the reform or repeal side of the argument.
I think that, you know, if we had a notice provision where if a platform knows that there's a copyright infringement and does nothing, then they can be sued for copyright. So I think that's one thing. I think that there should be carve-outs for product liability cases. There should be carve-outs when the injuries are really, really extreme, like wrongful death cases. A lot of my cases are ones that involve wrongful death. And I think also when a platform involves offline encounters, like dating apps and stuff, you know, I think that there should be an exception for those types of things.
As far as the reforms and the carve-outs or the workarounds to Section 230, I think you have to proceed with caution there.
That's Jessica Malugin, Director of the Center for Technology and Innovation at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
The one time we've done that legislatively was about two bills, SESTA and FOSTA. And in trying to address that problem of sex trafficking that was being facilitated online, it swept up a lot of adjacent but not sex trafficking content. So it's chipping away at our First Amendment rights. And it also, no matter how well-meaning the legislation was, what it ended up happening in reality is a lot of those sort of at-risk sex workers were pushed into more of a dark corner of society. And then we were able to see, so what are the real-world consequences of these carve-outs? And it was that a lot of speech that wasn't the problem being addressed but was adjacent to that problem was taken down by platforms because they didn't want to incur the legal risk of carrying anything even close to that. And you're pushing sex workers to sort of the dark shadows of things, which may be less safe for them. So, you know, I just don't look at Section 230 and think it's not working, what a disaster. I think for the vast majority of its functioning, it's doing a beautiful job, and look at all the great stuff it creates. And there are some problems, and we can have conversations about those problems. A lot of the child safety online that would involve workarounds to Section 230, I think you would be better served by focusing on supporting law enforcement efforts against the bad actors themselves, and directly would protect children more than the Section 230 workaround. And I think the best recommendation I can give to people who have problems with Section 230 is that parental empowerment is going to take care of so much of that. So as the tools get more numerous, more accessible, easier to use, people have time on that learning curve to understand that as parents, there are things they can do that aren't endlessly time-consuming and complicated. Those tools get better. We get more educated as parents. That's probably where you're going to make your biggest impact. Child welfare questions like that are not going to be solved with one top-down legislative workaround or carve-out from Section 230 that it, you know, will make a bunch of trial attorneys wealthy and will shut down a lot of legal speech. But I don't think the payoff in helping kids is going to be there. So I think it's a really valuable case study to look at that one legislative exception and say, if we want to do anything, let's make sure we don't make the same mistakes we made here.
The thing that trust and safety, and in some ways all risk management, but I think particularly the sort of subjective, squishy human risk management fields teach you to do, is think about choices backwards.
Dave Wilner, former trust and safety expert for Facebook, Airbnb, and OpenAI.
You think about choice as a process of selecting the best thing to do. And I don't think about choice that way anymore. I think about choice as selecting the least worst thing to do. And I think that that logic basically applies to regulation, right? It's almost a little more medical. Like, do no harm gets framed as never do anything wrong. But it also means, like, pick the one where you're going to be the least sad about the way that it goes wrong. Really, technically, you're mini-maxing regret. It's like, what is the thing where I feel the least bad about all the ways this doesn't work when it inevitably doesn't work at the end of the day? All of these conversations would be more productive if people were more used to thinking in a defensive driving mode instead of a sort of consumerist, preferential, what is the best television mode, right? We're trained by our consumer society to be like, what's the best one? What's the best car? What's the car that will make me the most happy? And I'm like, okay, what's the car that's going to, like, definitely not kill me or my children? Right? And, like, if that's a little boring, that's great, because I'll be alive to be bored and I will enjoy not being dead. And, like, right? Like, it's weird, but, like, that's the logic.
All this leaves one unanswered question. What do the writers of Section 230 think?
People write these articles, oh my goodness, Section 230 is the reason we have all this horrible stuff. And you know, I practically had legislators say, well, when you retire or die or something, then we'll get rid of this because we will be able to have a different debate.
That's Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. He stands by Section 230 as good law.
Every few months, there are some senators who go to the floor, I think you've written about it a couple of times, and they propose solutions that are much worse than anything that exists today. And I object, and they know that I could force a discussion over a period of time that would make their arguments fall apart. So I'm prepared to continue this kind of discussion. But, you know, I know people from various philosophical points of view are going to continue to highlight what they think are problems. But on the basic proposition, is this good for users, particularly for users without power and clout, the typical person, and not big corporations? I'm prepared to continue to deal with these kind of rearguard actions of people coming forward and saying the sky's going to fall unless we get rid of 230. But the vast majority of proposals are worse than some of the challenges today.
Chris Cox, former California representative and Section 230 co-writer, says that the whole debate hinges on misinformation.
And so the misinformation about Section 230 is that it's a special carve-out for, you know, people that don't deserve it, and that the carve-out itself is creating the bad content. That sort of flips reality on its head. First of all, it's not anything special or a carve-out at all. What it says is that the people who are responsible for creating bad content are legally responsible, and that content moderation that attempts to
control, some of that is protected. That's what Section 230 is actually doing. And the idea that we would be better off without those kinds of protections, again, stands reality on its head, because the incentive, remember, before Section 230 was anything goes. So no content moderation is the result of repealing Section 230. And if you were unhappy about illegal activity on the internet, just wait until it can't be moderated at all.
Next episode, we're gathering some of the top experts in tech policy in a roundtable discussion to discuss their thoughts on the future of Section 230 and the internet.
So if you actually were to repeal it, then the internet, which is now insinuated into everyone's lives, pretty much all that they do, would be in peril.
The reality is the enforcement tools that we have just are a bit blunt. And so we hit a lot of stuff that we didn't mean to hit, and we miss a lot of stuff that everybody agrees we really should have caught.
We're at another inflection point on U.S. tech policy here. And it's important, if we want to get that right, to look back and have an informed and complete picture of what we did the last time.